Welcome to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Carl Nellis, a host of the channel, and today I'm talking with Irina Dumitrescu, professor of English Medieval Studies at the University of Bonn. We're talking about her new book, The Experience of Education in Anglo-Saxon Literature, just out from Cambridge University Press. Irina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you, Carl.
Well, you've written such an interesting book that pulls together so many fields, so many different interests of mine, and so many aspects of intellectual history. You walk us through, for instance, you touch on affect theory and pedagogy, and there are even questions of literary interpretation, kind of in the ways that it's changed since the Middle Ages to today. I'm really excited to talk with you about this book. If you would, tell us what brought you to a project like this in the course of your career. What got you to the experience of education in Anglo-Saxon literature?
Well, I think there's sort of there are short-term causes and long-term causes,
right.
as there always are with large projects like this. So I thought for a long time that it started in my encounter with a very strange and enigmatic old English poem called Solomon and Saturn, which is this weird dialogue between two mysterious figures in which one of them wants to learn about the Lord's Prayer or the Paternoster, and the other one says strange things about its magical powers. and you know, people always try to find the sources of its odd little lines, but I realized that it was actually a teacher-student encounter, and it was a very dark one, slightly scary one. And so I became interested in reading it as a scene of instruction, as a scene of teaching, and what that might tell us about the Anglo-Saxon imagination of teaching. Once I was well into the project, I realized that I had more personal reasons for it too. I had actually long been interested in reading campus novels. They were my fun reading during high school. I was sure I would never study English because English departments always seemed like places where people were constantly, you know, having affairs with each other and getting into all sorts of troubles from my campus novel reading. And also my father was my mother's professor. I had grown up in a family context that was shaped by the teacher-student relationship and really continued to be shaped for the duration of their marriage. And so I realized that it was a very personal topic, even as I was trying to engage with the Anglo-Saxon materials in a responsible and scholarly way. That's really where I think where my interest in the emotions and the things that are unsaid or happen between the lines, or I only hinted at, came in.
It starts with Solomon and Saturn. How does it grow from there into a full book project?
Well, what started happening was that I saw these instructional moments everywhere, all over Anglo-Saxon literature. And in fact, my book is really just a tiny slice of what there is. I started seeing that sometimes in the course of a longer text, two characters will just for a little while take on an instructional relationship to each other, and they'll have a teacher-student moment. They might be two adult figures. They might be Christ and a saint, or a saint and a hermit, right? But they might, for a moment, have a kind of classroom moment with each other. And so I started seeing them everywhere. And I also began to look at what I could find about how Anglo-Saxon education actually took place. And that rendered some very interesting materials. So one of my chapters is on a text that's become an obsession of mine. I actually taught it this morning. Elfrich Botta's Colloquies, which are a set of dialogues that we think were composed for the teaching of oral Latin. And they are absolutely wild and difficult and full of raucous swear words and fighting and violence and hints of sexual abuse and arguments. And so I became really interested in how what was going on in classrooms as well, and how, what some of it, their texts can tell us about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I really looked at both. I'm interested in representations of education in this book, but I was also very much interested in how teaching, especially teaching of literacy, took place.
There's a small note in your introduction as you're describing the book and kind of setting out that describes why you focus on literature and not on material sources for understanding Anglo-Saxon education. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's really hard to draw the line between literature and other sources. We don't have an enormous amount for very elementary education, which is what I'm mm-hmm. the most interested in. Mm-hmm. We certainly have grammars of Latin early in Anglo-Saxon England. We have collections of riddles, which I think are very closely connected to the kinds of mental training they wanted, especially monastic environments, teachers wanted to imbue their students with.
Mm-hmm.
We have quite a few texts that reflect perhaps more theoretically on education. They're translations of Latin often. Mm-hmm. So actually the topic is just so immensely broad. and I would hesitate to say this is literary and this is not. I have a chapter on Bede's Ecclesiastical History mm-hmm. Of the English people. And of course it's a book that's considered a history,
yes.
but you can also close read it as a literary text. And I think Bede composes it very deliberately to be close read in certain moments. And so I actually wouldn't say that line really makes a lot of sense. But I am interested in the literary qualities of all kinds of texts, whether we would, you know, see them as a biography or a history or an imaginative poem at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're literate Anglo-Saxons, and probably illiterate ones too, were simply very, very skilled at communicating several things at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And they give little clues to how one might read different levels of the same text.
You introduced the idea of grammatica at the beginning of the book. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, this is Martin Irvine. Martin Irvine, who used to be a scholar of Anglo-Saxon and medieval literature, wrote a really important book, I want to say, about now 30 years ago, on grammar teaching in the Middle Ages as being not just about teaching how to write, read and write Latin and how the grammar works as we might understand it, but really teaching a certain structure of thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a way of approaching texts and taking them apart. This is a very simplified version of what's a very long and complex book.
Yes, yeah.
I think we see this, especially in the early Anglo-Saxon period, when there's a kind of fashion for composing collections of riddles in Latin
mm-hmm.
Among Anglo-Saxons. They get this collection of 100 riddles by a sort of mysterious, possibly North African figure called Symphosius. And we don't know if that's his real name or if he's just dinner party boy.
yeah.
And, you know, they're sort of riddles on various objects. And the Anglo-Saxons love this, and you have people who are otherwise quite serious churchmen also writing collections of riddles on this model. And I think this is a theory I don't really describe in the book, but I think this is because they're really interested not just in teaching their pupils how to read Latin, but also how to read texts in an imaginative, open-ended way that's attuned to paradox and strange relationships between things and complexity. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason they do this is because they have to deal with the Bible. If you believe that it is scripture, that it is sacred scripture, you cannot read it literally, right?
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely
right.
doesn't
right.
make sense. So you have to cultivate a kind of an interpretive state of mind or interpretive cognitive ability to be able to think in the right kind of metaphorical and imaginative way that you need mm-hmm. in order to make sense of the Bible
mm-hmm.
and still believe in it as the revealed word of God, right?
Yeah.
So I think they're using this very playful little form of the riddle to train very high level imaginative thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going hand in hand with Latin education, right? With learning the Latin language and with learning meter of Latin poetry and so on.
Mm-hmm. One of the other aspects of the introduction that helps to set out the rest of the book is your emphasis on something you've already touched on, the way that you're going to discuss encounters between pupil and teacher, and really focus on those kind of relationships. And you especially talk about the form of the dialogue. You spend some time talking about ambivalence toward authority, navigating or inspiring or working with pedagogically useful emotions. I thought that was a great phrase. Can you talk a little bit about maybe triangulate between encounters between people and teacher and the dialogue and how your book engages the idea of pedagogically useful emotions?
Well, I think one of the really, so as I say in my book, dialogues are just a standard mode of pedagogy in late antiquity, obviously in the ancient period in late antiquity, the early Middle Ages, right? They don't really go out of fashion, and they're incredibly useful for everything from conveying basic trivia, or, you know, doing a catechism, covering basic knowledge, grammatical information, to exploring higher level philosophical ideas. Mm-hmm. So you have the dialogues of Augustine and Boethius and so on. One of the things that's quite interesting when you start to look at these dialogues more closely is that what we might expect would be a medieval way of thinking about teacherly authority or pedagogic authority falls apart very quickly. The teachers aren't always authoritative, or to put it a different way, they might have some special knowledge, but the relationship between the pupil and the teacher might be a fraught one. So you have, I'll think of an example from my texts in Solomon and Saturn. Solomon, I argue, he seems to be the teacher, right? But he never really teaches Saturn what the Paternoster is. He just talks about it and how great it is. And then he basically insults Saturn by saying that, he who does not know the Paternoster is like wandering cattle, you know, he's like this exile demonic figure, but he doesn't really teach him. And then fundamentally, I think he actually threatens him. He sort of reads Saturn as this kind of demonic wandering figure and suggests that, you know, if you knew the Paternoster, it would kill you. In another one of my texts, the Old English Andreas, which is just a wonderful, wonderful and wacky epic poem. there's a teaching encounter on a boat, and Andrew is just kind of a terrible saint. He's a really real disappointment of a saint and apostle. And he's having this conversation with the captain of the ship, who he thinks is a nice-looking and intelligent young man. He doesn't realize that the captain is actually Christ, who has disguised himself and is kind of asking him all sorts of leading questions about Jesus, right? About Christ on earth. And at one point, Andrew starts to realize that he's being tested in some way, or he's being asked trick questions. And only later, once he's brought to his destination and he wakes up, does he realize who he had been talking to. So you get these moments of disguise or mistrust, or even potentially sexual temptation between teacher and student. And I think Anglo-Saxons writing about this material are very much interested in the tension between teacher and student. And I think part of the lesson for the reader of the text, or the listener, the hearer of the text, lies in that conflict between teacher and student, rather than in adopting the student position and just accepting or learning what the teacher figure has to say. And I think they're getting this out of late antiquity, too. They're getting an approach to dialogue which isn't as straightforward in terms of teachers being good as we might think. And I think we now we read Plato critically now, or some of us read Plato critically, and we don't assume that Socrates is necessarily always giving straight lessons, as it were. There are people who read Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy really is potentially also being more critical of the teacher figure. So there's a rich tradition in late antiquity of of encounters between teachers and students in which the teachers are a little bit sketchy. And they're interested in these negative emotions like fear, like curiosity, like desire, like mistrust, and what kind of potential cognitive uses those emotions might have.
Yeah. One final note that I really appreciated from the introduction is when you set out that, of course, there's not just one theory of teaching in Anglo-Saxon literature, but that there are multiple theories of teaching and of learning. And so it's not like we're saying that all of the texts hold the same view, no. But that part of what we're seeing across the course of your argument, across the course of the various texts over the arc of your book, is many views, sometimes in agreement, sometimes conflicting, that there is an array of approaches to teaching and learning in Anglo-Saxon literature.
Absolutely. And I think I could go further and say teaching is much more than what I described it in this book as well. I've basically narrowed in, you could say, on two kinds of education, spiritual education and education in literacy. Mm-hmm. And I think they make sense because they often are very closely linked up. Sometimes learning to read and learning to read Latin is part of entering a spiritual life. And sometimes spiritual things are described in the language of very basic classroom education, right? So I think those make sense together. But of course, it's just a tiny slice. I'm not talking about teaching in medicine or in law or in a warfare, the war, or in craftsmanship, or in manners, right?
right.
Or certainly how not. To be a good person. And we do have, there's actually scholars are doing quite interesting works on learning in these various areas and how it seems to have been passed on. And so I really took quite a thin little slice of the teaching continuum. But even within that, there are a lot of different ideas. The issue of curiosity, to what extent curiosity is a useful urge in the teaching relationship. Texts tend to present that in quite conflicted ways. The issue of how violence, suffering, and pain can play a role in the process of learning. Texts, again, show quite different approaches to that question throughout the Middle Ages, but also in the Anglo-Saxon period. So and the issue of forgetting, right? To what extent is forgetting a useful thing or a negative part of the teaching process?
Mm-hmm. You do some really interesting things in the introduction with Alfred and suffering, but let's jump past those. In chapter one, you really dive into that connection between literacy and spiritual learning with Bede, and especially the John of Beverly miracle. Tell us what you do with Bede on language through looking at the John of Beverly miracle.
Well, this is a wonderful, wonderful little miracle, which not that many people have looked at. People tend to think about Cædmon as the big story for English literature when it comes to Bede's ecclesiastical history. Cædmon, of course, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, is the cowherd who's caught at a party, unable to compose songs on the fly, and then has an angelic vision and is basically commanded to sing about creation and miraculously composes vernacular English verse on the creation. Mm-hmm. And it then becomes a monk and is taken into the monastery at Whitby and there composes more verse on biblical themes. So that's sort of Bede's telling of the beginning of English religious poetry. And that's, it's a wonderful story, and that's the one everybody goes to. But actually, the funny thing about that story is it has no actual English in it. Bede gives us the whole story in Latin, and he translates Cædmon's hymn into Latin and says, well, you know, it's not quite the same as it is in the original, but here it is in Latin. Well, a few chapters later in book five of the history, he has a scene which is patterned along similar lines, I think. And in it, a mute youth with scrofulous hair is brought to St. John of Beverly, now St. John, Bishop John at that point, who seems to have a kind of habit of healing people at a particular time of year. And this man, what I find so fascinating about it is he's never spoken in his entire life. And it's clear from the context that it's not just that he hasn't spoken. He hasn't communicated in signs. He hasn't written. There are all kinds of language miracles throughout the Middle Ages where people can communicate in other ways, even if they can't speak. But this youth has been stuck in his own head for his entire life. He's like a Kaspar Hauser figure. And John makes him stick his tongue out and says, he makes a sign of the cross over it and says, say ah, say be, say tse, you know, or C, however, ABC. And the boy says them, and then John teaches him words, and then John teaches him sentences. And the youth is so ecstatic at being able to finally escape this entrapment of his own mind that he stays up all night talking to people. Mm. And what I find so fascinating is this is an English youth, right? This is clearly not a literate person. It's not someone who knows Latin. But John is teaching him to speak English the way you would teach someone to read and write Latin. So he's really thinking about the English language as something that can have a process of learning, and I think also a grammar like Latin. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a wonderful moment of the ABCs also being a kind of charm, right? In other parts of the history, you have letters that unbind prisoners. In this case, it's the alphabet. The alphabet has this charm-like quality to unbind the mute boy's tongue. So I think he's really kind of, and he makes him say yes, actually. He makes him say yes first. Really, the boy has to say yes in his own language. And that beat gives in English and translates it into Latin. So there's a sort of sense that I think that this is the speaker of English, right? But English comes through a Christian miracle, and it comes through Latin learning.
So you remark toward the end of the chapter that this is a fresh model for English participation in the Roman Church, but you also spend some time in the chapter talking about this as vernacular liberation.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go on to talk about how the youth goes out into the secular world. Can you bring us to that point in your argument?
Well, I think what's interesting, especially if you read, if you think about this scene together with the Cadman scene, which are really parallel, Cadman's this simple man who is then brought into the monastery. You know, they have him perform his trick. Everyone's convinced by it. And they bring him into the monastery. And maybe he also learns to read and write. But in any case, he's folded in more closely into the monastic community. He probably worked on monastic lands before, but now he becomes a monk. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense with Cadman's story, okay, this is England and English poetry being brought into an institution, right? Mm-hmm. An international Christian Latinate institution. Well, the mute youth has a slightly different story. And I find it interesting that he comes afterwards. John seems to have had a familia of people who probably traveled with him and whom he taught. And he offers the youth, the real John, not just this particular representation. Yeah. He offers this youth, as Bede tells it, the opportunity to join him in this group or entourage. And the boy says no. And he just goes back. He just goes back.
Yeah,
and I think this is so wonderful. Okay, you know, he learns English the way you might learn to read and write Latin. Figuratively, he's part of this Latin world, right? This is another scene of England being brought into this cosmopolitan Latin literate culture. But then he just turns his back on it. He takes his language and goes home. And I think that's a really beautiful, beautiful moment of creating a space outside the church. And it may have been that Bede heard the story that way, and he just had to be true to his material. That's also possible, right? Mm-hmm. But he includes the story.
Yeah. I thought you put it so beautifully at the end of the chapter where you talk about how in the course of his teaching, John made the boy say yes, but that the story concludes when the boy learns to say no.
Yeah.
The next chapter Solomon and Saturn, where you really dive into prayer. So we kind of go from learning the way you structure the book from letters to prayer. You also introduce what you mentioned earlier, the fact that in most of these teacher-student encounters, it's not usually education in the way that we think of it today, adhering to childhood, but that it's usually an adult student as well as an adult mm-hmm. teacher. Can you talk about what role that plays in Solomon and Saturn in particular?
In Solomon and Saturn, the student is a prince who's traveled the world in search of wisdom and so on. So he's clearly, he's at least a graduate student, let's say. And he's now sought himself a kind of dangerous supervisor. But I think a lot of medieval texts do, and this is as true for Solomon and Saturn as it is for Chaucer, is they like to use the image of elementary education in order to work through ideas of higher level learning, as it were. And Solomon and Saturn plays on the curious qualities of the Lord's Prayer, which is, as far as we can tell, over a very, very long period of time, one of the very first texts to be learned or practiced when a child learns to read and write, along with the Psalms in certain cases, and the Credo, or the Creed. The Our Father is up there, right? A number of Anglo-Saxon writers basically say, you know, if lay people are going to know one thing, it should be the Lord's Prayer and the Creed, right? These are the basics. These are the things that every Christian should know. And it's a great idea to translate them because people need to know these essential texts of the faith. So it's, you know, you even see this, in early modern primers too, right? The alphabet mm-hmm. and maybe some syllables, and then the Paternoster and the Creed, right? These are very typical. So on the one hand, it's the basics, right? It's the earliest thing you do. It's kindergarten, right? Or at least grade one.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's also a prayer that has a tradition of commentary, of translation, has difficult passages, you know, deliver us from evil or from the evil one. What is it? So it's also a very high level text, right? Mm-hmm. In which the simple language can be taken apart and commented on in complex ways. So this poem is really about exploring how you can know this prayer in different ways and also how you can be ignorant in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that the Solomon and Saturn is so interested in is how you might know a prayer but not really pay attention to it anymore. Mm-hmm. And as I worked on this text, I started finding mentions in all kinds of places about the problem of distraction, right? Mm-hmm. Or of how important it is to pray with attention, right? With lively or careful attention. I think this was, especially in a monastic context, very much a concern. Mm-hmm. How do you memorize a text, sing it or speak it over and over and over again, and still actually pray with it, really feel the words, mm-hmm. right? Especially if it's part of the monastic routine, if it's not you doing it spontaneously. And I think they were very good at working out mental tricks to try and connect to the language, which was very well known and rote. So it's also about that kind of higher level ignorance when you really, you maybe know a text and you may know the importance of the text and you may be a good Christian monk and have been praying it for years and know what it's supposed to mean, but can you still really pray it mm-hmm. rather than going through the motions or letting your mind wander?
And that's where you bring in the idea of mimetic desire in the character of Saturn.
Yeah, I think basically this is Solomon and Saturn is a great story of a failed teaching encounter. Mm-hmm. And it has a very interesting scene near the end, which is key to this in one of the versions. Basically, Solomon says, you know, this is what happens when someone sings the prayer, the Paternoster, and the individual letters of the Lord's Prayer in Latin become warriors and attack the devil or devils in brutal, gruesome ways.
Yeah.
And in one of the versions of the poem breaks off right near the beginning of that. The other one, we have this whole letter battle. And in that, the version that we have the whole thing, there are runes, the runic equivalents to those Latin letters, Roman letters in the manuscript. And they're not read out loud. There are Old English poems where you would read the runes out loud as part of the poem. But in this, in Psalm and Saturn, they're silent. So I think what was happening was that the person, if someone were, was actually reading this poem aloud, they would have had to skip the runes. They would have seen the runes and had to skip them in order for the poem to work. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, at some subtle level, they're being reminded that they're reading, right? They're not listening because they would be missing something if they were only listening. And they're being reminded of their own process of education and their own learning of literacy, probably involving the Paternoster at some point very early on. I think what the poem does is stage the scene of failed teaching, where Saturn never really learns it, in order to encourage the reader to reconnect or to desire this this prayer, which he already knows. Mm-hmm. But he has to feel what Saturn feels, which is this incredible burning longing for this quotidian prayer.
In the next chapter, where you really get into Bada's colloquies, violence takes center stage. And you talked about that a couple of times already. But one of the things you do in beginning this chapter and in positioning the way you're going to talk about the violence in the colloquies is you make a careful distinction between descriptions of violence in the literature and what we might think of as the way we stereotypically imagine the Middle Ages as a time of violence. And you say what we're addressing here in some ways is violence as a motif in the literature and the way that does or does not connect with or does or does not represent the way that life necessarily was lived. Can you talk about that a little bit and address maybe that stereotype?
Sure. I think there's a very powerful idea that medieval people were, well, I could say it's a little bit the Game of Thrones idea, These kind of burly people in furry coats with skull jewelry, walking around bashing each other's heads in. And so if in the classroom you beat a little boy mercilessly, well, nobody thinks too much of that, right? And there's certainly, I think it's still fair to say that they had different attitudes towards pedagogical violence or correction than some people today.
Right.
I've had students in their 40s who had gone to school in Texas and in California who were disciplined, physically disciplined by their teachers, right? So it's not really... it's not that everyone today has decided not to be pupils anymore. But certainly was a more common idea and perhaps just standard. I think though you have a number of voices. If you read up on this, you realize one, it's not that it was unquestioned, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, it was normal and nobody would have been put in jail for whipping the little boy who hadn't learned his paradigm. But there is a sense that there are problems with violence. So one of the problems with violence or with punishment more broadly is that in an early monastic context, the teacher should have been supervising pupils so carefully that they didn't have a chance to do bad things and be punished by them. So there's a Carolingian educator who basically writes that pupils should just be observed so carefully and so closely that they are never have to be punished in any way, not just hit. And it's a failure on the part of the teacher if the little boy misbehaves, right, or has the opportunity to misbehave.
That's a little panopticon almost.
It's very panopticon, and there's an enormous amount of wonderfully Foucauldian aspects to early monastic education, like sleeping chambers where the light is kept on all night, lest the boys or the monks do anything untoward in their beds, right? So there's quite a lot of that. A nicer version is attached to St. Anselm, where a teacher comes to him and says, you know, I beat my pupils all the time and they still act like beasts. And Anselm says, well, if you treat them like animals, why would you expect them to behave like anything?
Yeah.
Animals. And you have stories of monastic pupils upset at their teacher's cruelty and turning on him and so on. So there's definitely, I think there's an awareness that excessive, unreasonable violence can have negative effects, right? Negative behavioral effects. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a free for all. Right. Even though you do also have people saying versions of spare the rod, spoil the child, or mm-hmm. or that corporal punishment is really a sign of a father's love for his son and so on. Right. This is how you raise your child well. So I don't want to say those don't exist, but I think it's more complicated. And I think a lot of people do notice, probably who worked with children did notice, that it actually sometimes didn't help very much if they just beat the kids a lot. So I think a lot of the times when we are reading about schoolroom violence in medieval texts, the purpose of that is imaginative. Mm-hmm. I think they know that, in fact, I know that they know that violent images are incredibly powerful for mnemonically, right? So mm-hmm. if you want to memorize things, and Mary Carruthers has done an enormous amount of really important work on this, on medieval, ancient and medieval mnemonic practices. If you want to memorize a set of things, you think up really outrageous, grotesque, and potentially violent images, right? Mm-hmm. And so they know that this is something that works as a mental trick. And there are ways that you can use violence or violent imagery to clarify the differences between things, right? Mm-hmm. So Alfrich in his grammar talks about the passive conjugation of the verb, right? And he draws the contrast between I whip and I am whipped. Mm-hmm. If you don't have any sense of what a passive voice might be, that's a very good way to get that across. Whereas if you say I love versus I am loved, or I see versus I am seen, right? That's a little more vague. That's a little more abstract. You know, why can't we both love each other and so on? Why can't we both see each other at the same time? The difference between I whip and I am whipped is a big one. And you can imagine that on your own body to figure out what the grammatical form is. So I think in those moments, we shouldn't read Alfrich and think, okay, that means he was whipping his students constantly. It's that he knew that that's a very powerful image to draw a distinction with. So I think we just have to be very, very skeptical every time we read one of these representations or mentions of violence. Sometimes the important thing is what kind of what the mental image is doing, not that it's telling us something about a real life classroom or situation.
Mm-hmm. Can you also talk a little bit about what Botta says within the colloquies themselves about his joking words and how he challenges readers to be critical readers almost, or to think carefully about how they're interpreting the colloquies themselves?
Well, Alfrich Botta is such a funny figure. We don't know anything about him really, except that he was interested in Alfrich of Ancham's work, and that he seems to have composed the school textbook. But we don't know much more than that. And he's sometimes thought of as a rogue figure, you know, because people think like, what kind of a man would compose such a terrible set of dialogues for his students to learn from? But he is, as you pointed out, he's actually doing something quite subtle and very, very difficult to pin down. He has a kind of master figure at the end, I've mixed joking with wise words in these dialogues, because little boys like to joke and they like to be silly, and they like that more than serious things, right? So there's a sense in there that he's telling us not to take these too seriously, but they also do have serious themes, and he's often. He often adapts passages from older Latin learning dialogues but makes whatever what was naughty in them much naughtier. Whatever was a little bit troubling, much more troubling. So instead of a young man asking a young woman for a kiss before he goes on a trip, it's an older monk asking a younger monk for a kiss. Mm-hmm. And the younger monk saying, no, I don't dare to kiss you. They're not supposed to do this. So he very deliberately crafts these troublesome situations. A couple of scenes where older monks, sometimes drunk, ask younger monks to accompany them to the bathroom and to assist them in the bathroom. If reformed monasteries in the late 10th century in England were not supposed to have this kind of behavior going on, right? Mm-hmm. You don't send a little boy alone with an older monk to the bathroom. But in Bada's colloquies, the boy say, no, I don't think I should do that. And the teacher says, no, go ahead. Go ahead, ask the, you know, help that old man in the bathroom. It's fine. Yeah. So it's very difficult to try to scoop what the moral lesson is out of these dialogues. Yeah. He's definitely exploring difficult situations sometimes. He's exploring fights between the boys. He's exploring how difficult it is to be punished and how humiliating it is to be punished. And how the sort of tricky situation of being in a monastic context where you have to be obedient, but the older monks may be trying to get you drunk or trying to be too close to you. Yeah. But he doesn't give us a really clear moral where the boys say, no, thank you, and then they go away pure and unsullied. In fact, in the end, even though the boys try to preserve some distance, they say no. Bada teaches his pupils to say no, mm-hmm. but then they say yes afterwards. So I'm still not quite sure what to do with that that aspect of things, yeah.
Can you talk a little more about the challenge of interpreting suffering or translating suffering? I'm trying to get a real sense of what's going on with the Anglo-Saxon when it's addressing suffering directly.
Yeah, and the word is throwing or throwing, and it's used primarily for pain, right? For suffering pain. But sometimes Anglo-Saxons stretch it for other purposes. So Alfrich, when he writes his grammar of Latin, but he writes it in English, has to figure out English terms or English equivalents for the Latin grammatical terms. Mm-hmm. And for the passive, he uses throwum, which I think is really kind of an innovation, or he's copying the work that the Latin passio can do, in that it can be can refer to grammar or to you know, suffering in action or suffering pain, right? Mm-hmm. So he sort of stretches that word really wonderfully to serve as a grammatical term, but then it also makes you think, I think it would have made them think of actual suffering, right? Mm-hmm. That you might think of the passive voice in terms of suffering. Yeah, it's an interesting little slippage. But I think more broadly, what I would say is that Alfred Bada especially is very, very aware of how language of suffering can be very useful for learning grammar.
Yeah, so I wanted you to talk about throwing in chapter 3 because it comes back in a different usage or in maybe a slightly shifted usage. Mm-hmm. You know, the slippage is continuing in the life of St. Mary of Egypt, where you really dig into and pull a lot of the pieces of the book together in this final chapter. It's not the conclusion, but in this final chapter, in the life of St. Mary of Egypt, where there's a really interesting relationship between student and teacher with Zosimus and Mary, emotions are at the fore, questions of morality are at the fore. So talk to us about the life of St. Mary of Egypt and how it engages all the threads of your argument that have built up to that point in the book.
Well, the life of St. Mary of Egypt is an extremely outrageous late antique text, which is in Greek, and then it's translated into Latin and then into Old English, always in pretty close translations. And what's so outrageous about it is that in many saints' lives, you have a very pure, holy, extraordinary person, especially if their saints' lives centered on women, who is perhaps tempted with sex or threatened with rape, but manages to preserve their virginity and their purity, is dramatically and ostentatiously tortured. And that torture is the pasio, right? Mm-hmm. And that is, or the passion, it's also a word that throwing is used for, saints' passions, right? In just general Old English. Well, with Mary, she sleeps with everyone starting around the age of 12.
Right.
She doesn't even charge. She's not doing it for the money. It's not out of necessity. She just finds every man she can and has sex with him. And I think, in fact, we're even meant to read her as potentially a rapist, because at one point she follows these men onto a boat and forces them to do perverted things with her. And they can't really escape this, this nymphomaniac. At one point, she describes her sexual passion, right, mm-hmm. as throwing. But Old English throwing doesn't have the sense of passion as that kind of like a sexual emotion or longing. That's mm-hmm. the only place I could find it. So she actually, she really has her dramatic torture in the midst of her sexual desires. And it's a very, very different kind of saints' lives. It was also extremely popular in the Middle Ages. I wonder why. So it's translated into all sorts of vernacular versions. There are operas mm-hmm. about Mary of Egypt in the early modern, the modern period. So she's kind of a diva, I think. But I think what that story really crystallizes is a broader medieval, not just Anglo-Saxon, interest in learning from imperfection, mm-hmm. In figures who are sinful and what it might mean for a sinful or an outrageously sinful person to be shown the grace of God. Mm-hmm. And so in order to show how great God's grace is, the imperfection has to be played up, the sinfulness, the mm-hmm. desire, mm-hmm. the erotic longing, the singing and dancing and drinking of wine and so on. But I think they're also aware, and part of that is in the text already, that when you use ideas like that to teach, there's always the danger that you might be tempted. And Mary and Zosimus are out there in the desert having this teaching encounter, and he's asking her, you know, tell me about your youth, tell me more about all of this, to an extent which is a little creepy. And yep. she says, and she says, you know, please don't force me to tell, to narrate my life, because I fear that my words will pollute both you and this air.
Yeah, and the air, yeah.
So she knows to some extent she might tempt him, and yet she goes ahead with it because she has to tell him how bad she was in order to show him how magnificent God is. So I think what that really shows, the thread that pulls out of the whole book and all of the, or at least most of the instructional moments that I look at, is that there's a sense that dangerous emotions can be very useful pedagogically, but they have to be constantly kept in check, right? It's not necessarily that a certain urge or emotion or passion is good or bad, whether that's curiosity or suffering or fear or erotic longing or some other kind of desire. They're not easily categorized in these texts as good or bad, but they're a kind of fire-like, right, a kind of spark introduced mm-hmm. into the learning that could warm it up or could set it all on fire.
Right, right.
So I think that's what so many of these texts are exploring, this really tricky balance between creating a space for dangerous emotions and having absolute failure of teaching and of spiritual development. Mm-hmm. If those emotions get out of hand.
Mm. I think that's a great place to wrap up. We skipped over chapter 4, Recollection, where you really get into Andreas and you're talking about memory and riddles, and you even get into cannibalism and revenants and remixing and use of sources and all that. We'll have to leave that for readers of the book because we've taken up so much of your time already. Before we go, could you tell us maybe what you're working on now or what we might look for next from you?
I'm working on three things, and I'll describe them very fast. One comes out of my obsession with Mary of Egypt, and it's a study of women's charismatic performances in medieval literature and other medieval texts. So I'm interested in medieval divas, as it were, and how they fascinate and occasionally repulse. So that's going to be my next monograph. I'm also still very interested in Latin pedagogy over a longer period of time, at least until the Renaissance, and the use of strong emotions and language teaching, but that's a project I'm doing very slowly. And I'm also working on the proposal for a nonfiction book for the general public on the uses of imperfection, which very much comes out of this material, but also out of a wide range of interests that I have.
Well, we will keep an eye out for all three of those. Again, today we've been discussing the experience of education in Anglo-Saxon literature, just out from Cambridge University Press. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the New Books in Intellectual History channel of the New Books Network. Irina, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much, Carl.